Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. My name is Wade Wegner.
And I'm Steve Marks.
And we've got a great show today. As always, we're going to first cover the news, and we've got a feature. We're going to walk through some cool stuff on how to share resources, files, videos, you name it, you can share it, and how you can manage that whole process. And then we've got a great tip, something that Steve put together.
Tip for command line junkies, people who just hate GUIs of any sort will enjoy this tip, I think.
I don't like the word GUI, but I like...
All right, people who hate graphical user interfaces will like, it's a TUI, it's a textual user interface.
There we go, cool. All right.
I don't know, did we just invent that?
Is
that
it's not, actually, that's
that
not
used?
Bad.
It's a good one. All right.
I like it.
We're going to show a TUI.
Cool. All right, first news item, let's get to the top. How to clean up old Windows Azure diagnostics. So this is from the David Aiken.
The David Aiken.
Yeah, it's important. You have to say the.
Yeah.
It's not the.
Because otherwise you won't remember
David.
His Twitter handle.
It's the David Aiken.
David Aiken.
And essentially, we've got a couple of things from David here. A lot of
this is a very David heavy show.
It is a David heavy show. The David heavy show.
But this news is like, what, about 60%?
It is 60. In fact, it is exactly 60% David Aiken. So this first one is really, what he's done is he's taken the PowerShell commandlets and put together some really nice scripts that you can leverage. In this case, it's for cleaning up old Windows Azure diagnostics. So, and he's formatted the post really nicely. I mean, look, what the script will do, how to set it up, defining your variables. It's like he used to have a role in evangelism and creating content.
Yeah.
He's very good at this.
And then he just became like a
sales guy. Yeah, now he's a sales guy.
Yeah, but this is good. I mean, it's only for blogs.
Here.
I do want to point out that, like, when I read the title, I sort of assumed something about what this was that is not true. This is for cleaning up, like, the control files, the files that diagnostics uses to keep all the settings, and, like, IIS logs. I think specifically he's got IIS logs in here, although you could use this also for anything that you're using, that for blobs that sort of use the deployment ID in it. Because what it does is it looks for things that aren't the current deployment ID and deletes them.
Yep. Yeah, now, so just what the script will do, I think, also kind of cues up. Exactly right here. You can see list all the blobs that don't have the deployment ID in the URI. So, so that's the first. I mean, it's good stuff, good script.
Yep.
Take a look at it. Second news item.
This guy.
So the Windows Azure Toolkit for Windows Phone. So on Monday, released an update, 1.3.1. The reason we only did a minor increment of it is some of the major things that we updated is, first of all, we had the September release of the tools, so we made sure to convert not only the project templating for the Windows Azure Phone Toolkit, but all the sample applications. We also updated for the Windows Phone Developer Tools RTW release. So we had been on RC releases. There were about two, actually like four or five, beta/RC releases of the Mango tools. So we're at the RTW. And then we made some other updates as well. So we had introduced some samples that use SQL Azure, and we've updated those, so now we're actually using the universal providers for membership when using SQL Azure. So this is a nice update. Prior to that, we were actually just generating the membership database, you know, kind of the old way on our own. So now it's using the membership providers. It makes setup a lot easier because it uses that cool kind of code-first model or however it does it, but basically we'll generate the database when you first run. So that's very nice. We did a lot of refactoring for our storage client library for the phone. In fact, it's fully symmetric now with the actual Windows Azure storage client library that you can use in .NET. And then we've similarly modified the proxies that you communicate to through the toolkit. And then lastly, we included two different samples that are new samples, Tweet Your Blobs and CRUD SQL Azure. Great names.
I've always wanted to tweet my blobs. It's been a dream of mine. I have a lot of blobs.
Yep, you do.
And sometimes I want to tweet them.
So Tweet Your Blobs is essentially really showing how you can use blob storage, your own blob storage account, similar to like TwitPic, right? So on the phone, we've got a simple application where you take a picture with the phone. You can then create a new public, or you can create a container. You can make it public or keep it private. If you keep it private, when you tweet it, it's actually going to tweet the shared access signature, so it'll generate a short-term policy for it. And then if it's public, obviously, it can go directly to it. But very simple. You know, we just wanted to give some more simple samples that leverage the toolkit. So Tweet Your Blobs is fun. I think it also, plugs into Bitly. So you don't have to have a really long, it'll actually use the Bitly API to shorten it. And then CRUD SQL Azure really shows how you can use use some simple OData services for CRUD operations against SQL Azure.
We should have a tweet your CRUD.
Tweet your CRUD.
I think that should be the next one.
Nice. That's great. So, but I mean, the CRUD being create, read, update, yep. delete. So we just show those operations against SQL Azure from the phone. So pretty common pattern, but we wanted to make sure that it was explicitly highlighted. So those are nice. Plus, we've got a new dependency checker. You guys have seen.
It's pretty.
It is pretty. I'll show it again today. It's enhanced. Plus, the biggest enhancement is not just the way that it looks, but it's much more tightly integrated to Web PI. So anytime you don't have a resource and you need to install it, click install, it knows exactly in Web PI where that feed is for the resource, and consequently, like, all the dependencies, all that stuff get managed and handled by Web PI, which does a great job. So that's the phone toolkit. So definitely check it out, download it, build some apps.
Cool, good stuff. And now David again.
Again.
We talked briefly about the warnings that you now get in the SDK.
So 1.4.
Yeah, when the 1.4 tools, Visual Studio tools, came out, now you get these nice warnings that tell you, like, if you're referencing a DLL that you should be sending a copy local, but you didn't.
Yep. Like here, Entity Framework DLL.
Yeah. So good warnings. And basically what David posted about is, well, what if you actually want those to be errors? Because frequently one of these warnings pops up, but you go ahead and you hit deploy,
you didn't really
look at it, whatever, and it doesn't block anything, it'll just keep going, but there's a warning there. So then after it fails, you come back and you go, oh, it warned me already, but I hadn't paid attention.
And actually, for David, it was really annoying. He was annoyed.
It was beyond just something he wanted.
Yeah, because he didn't...
was annoyed that it didn't work this way. So David shows how you can set sort of to treat warnings as errors and make these into errors.
Yeah.
Now, we did want to make sure that we point out that you might not want to do this. There are reasons why those are just warnings and not errors.
Yeah, if you've seen any of the stuff that we've done on startup tasks and so forth, sometimes these dependencies, you'll add a dependency, like, as part of a startup task to install it. So you may tell your web role to download MVC and install it. I mean, there's a number of different ways to do it. And so always blocking on those things may be cumbersome, because you may want to actually install the resources that you're getting, getting notified about.
I also tend to ignore, there's a warning that you get for using
local storage,
like use development storage equals true. For using
for diagnostics.
Emulator, for pointing to the emulator for diagnostics, and if you're not actually
using it.
That, it's really not that bad. You should probably turn diagnostics off if you're not doing. I mean, I try to remember to do, but it's one of those things that it's really a warning. It's not really an error, and so you have to be careful about this. But if you, like David, would just like to, you can always
leave
those errors, and when one comes up and you're like, oh wait, that really should be a warning, you can go back and just set it back. So it's not that big of a deal, but it's nice that that is possible, and I didn't know how to do that. So
thank you, David.
It's a good helper thing. And you know what? We should hear some more from David Aiken, I think, because we haven't done that in a while.
Yeah, let's.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
I just
noticed too his not statistically significant. I actually like that. I hadn't noticed.
I didn't notice that either.
Yeah, it wasn't significant enough. It's kind of small.
Yeah.
But I like that as his kind of tagline for his blog.
Good. Yeah. Good work, David. This one is long, and we're not going to talk about it very much.
No, it is quite long.
Let's just point out, like, this is basically about, I mean, we've talked about these PowerShell commandlets a lot, one of the things they can do is they can manage diagnostic settings, and what David did is just go through in the full gory detail of how would you write a script to set up a whole bunch of different kinds of diagnostic settings, including event logs, IIS logs, perf counters, tracing, whatever, all that stuff. And so he's got just a bunch of examples.
My finger's getting tired when
really
I scroll down. There we go.
Yeah.
So here's here's the script. Okay, there we go. So
read through it in your own time and sort of go
print
look
it
at
out.
The ones that are most... bring it on a train with you sometime.
Yeah, exactly, when you commute.
And just take a look. It is good. It's very useful. It's a bit long, but I think the meta point is you can do that with the PowerShell commandlets. You may not have noticed that. And if you're looking to do it, there's some nice examples in David's post that'll help you along the way.
Yep, great. All right, so Mr. Nathan Totten.
And somehow, so this, I'm very confused about this post, because it says posted on October 21st, 2011. But it's about a new capability of Windows Azure that was introduced in, I think, November of 2010.
1.3.
So Nate is just catching up.
Well, I'll make excuses for Nate.
Okay.
So Nathan's been working with the platform since the very beginning, right?
Yes.
And he joined Microsoft recently, and he's built a lot of Windows Azure applications. And you know, when you get in the mode of like you jump in, especially when you're an early adopter and you figure out ways to get things to work.
Yep.
Sometimes it's hard to pick up on, you know, iterative and often, you know, difficult to follow updates.
Yes.
Just because, you know, we've got a cadence with these tools that's much faster than a typical product.
Yeah, and some of these, and in fact, in this case, so this is about, maybe we should just say what it is.
So what this is
about being able to edit your Windows Azure, really the web app part of your web role, like so sort of your ASP.NET app or something like that. Being able to edit that and then just sort of refresh and wherever without restarting the emulator.
Yep. When it's running in the compute emulator, right? Because
In
the early days, like up to like the 1.1, 1.2, you'd actually have to stop it and then make your changes, hit F5 again, and then it would repackage and deploy out your static resources.
Before we were using full IIS for this hosting, which meant it was actually all tied up in that same process and wherever. And now, with full IIS, we actually just point IIS at a folder with all your stuff, and so if you go make changes to that, including if you're running without debugging, you can actually make changes and rebuild it.
Yep.
And IIS will just sort of pick up the changes.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things where the reason we wanted to talk about it, even though it's actually not news, the capability is not new, is that just like Nate, I think most people have already figured out that they have to restart the thing. They have a workflow that they do for this.
Yep.
It's not like you would try this again unless someone pointed out, oh, wait, no, you can do this.
Yeah.
So that's why Nate put together the post, and that's why we wanted to cover it, is you actually can do that. You do have to be... I tend to use Control F5 and run without debugging, so that, like when I'm doing an MVC app or something, if I want to change a controller, which requires rebuilding, I run without debugging, and then I just, because my code's always perfect, so I don't actually need to debug. But I do want to make changes and try things a different way.
Yes.
And so I do Control F5 to run without debugging, so I can actually rebuild my MVC project without having to restart the emulator or whatever. It's a lot faster. It saves you, 15 seconds?
Yeah, but
maybe?
If you consider, like,
but every
how
time
many
you make
times
a little
per day,
change and whatever, it's actually, it adds up, and so it's very nice to be able to
do that. It's actually analogous to, you know, the model of having to redeploy out to Windows Azure, right? Only Windows Azure, it's 8 minutes or so. Here it's, you know, 15 to 20 seconds, but that makes a difference, so.
Yeah,
it's cool.
So that's cool. So he's got the details. He actually went through and figured out exactly what can you do and what can't you. Like, what changes can you make while debugging, which is basically, as long as you don't have to rebuild,
right,
you can make changes to, like, CSHTML files or JavaScript or CSS
HTML,
or things like that. But you can also, you can rebuild as long as you're not in
not
the middle
debugging.
Of debugging.
Yep.
And you can do that too.
Yep, so
it's got
some good
details
stuff
there.
Yep. All right. So we're on to the feature.
What are we talking about?
So there's a project that we've been working on for quite a long time. Steve's been familiar.
It's been quite a while.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
So I'll rewind a little bit. So my team, so in DPE, we produce a lot of content resources, and we work with a very large community of people. It's not only external individuals, but, you know, Microsoft internal employees, people worldwide in the field, and so forth. And so when we're updating, you know, training kits, as there's new releases of, you know, SDK or tools and so forth, we need a way to be able to share them out to these people, and securely.
And controlled, I mean, we want to share them with a list of people who have signed NDAs with us or something like that. And we want to make sure that we're not sharing it with anybody else, and that we have some accountability over that.
Yep. And it's not just, some of these samples are smaller, but so we had looked at things like SkyDrive, which is a great option, because there's permissions built in there, but there's also some limitations, like not being able to have a single resource over 100 megabytes, things like that. So, to us, I mean, you know, we work with Windows Azure. We wanted a tool running on Windows Azure.
Well, where do we have some storage that where we could just store really big
files
if we wanted to?
Yeah. So BlobShare, essentially what it is it's a tool, it's a website that manages most everything for you. It handles invitations to users so that they can register themselves. It handles how you do permissions on top of it. You can define different groups and roles. Gives you an opportunity to upload resources and then attach permissions to it. And the other thing that we wanted to do is to provide a way to audit what people are actually doing. So we can know if someone actually downloads a resource, if they, you know, make a change and so forth. So it also provides some simple auditing of activities and so forth. And so we built that as a tool, and we've you know, refined it over months. I mean, we've been using it for a while, and we've kept making it better, and we finally made it available as a sample and a resource. And so last week, I very quietly released it because I knew this week was going to be busy, so I just got it out there. So last Friday, got it up there. I think this is the first public announcement of BlobShare. So, and it's up in CodePlex, so you can actually download it. And what I want to do today is just show some of the pieces. It's quite a large app. I think we won't go through all the various aspects of it today, but at least wanted to kind of kick that off. So essentially, go to CodePlex. You know, the URL is blobshare.codeplex.com. We'll provide that link. And you know, I always recommend take a look at some of the documentation first. We really do try to get some good documentation.
Unlike most projects that you'll find, where clicking on the documentation tab may be a waste of your time.
Yeah. So we try to outline. It's kind of small here, at least on my screen. So kind of what the architecture is here. You can see, you know, central to everything really here is Windows Azure platform. Here we've got our compute tier. Mm-hmm. We use the access control service for auth, and that's one of the things, right? We also didn't want to bind people to one identity provider, so ACS frees us up from that. We use Blob Storage as a part of it. SQL Azure we use for, Blob Storage is great for all the resources, but you know, when you start thinking permissions and auditing and so forth, having a relational data store is really key. So we use SQL Azure for that. And then, we have concepts of different types of users, administrator and users. So,
and then some email also.
Exactly.
That was in that picture, but right. There's you already mentioned sending invitations.
Exactly. Yep.
Getting people to sign up that way and where. I think that's worth calling out because email is something people often ask about how to do on Windows Azure.
Yeah.
We've got some material about how to do it in various places, but now here's a sample
that shows
app
how to do it. Yep.
That we're actually using that uses that.
And to be clear, we're relaying to an external SMTP service. So. Yep. So you'll want to have one of those services available if you really want to leverage it.
Yep.
And then, of course, we've got prerequisites, you know, all the documentation for how to get started. You know, basically, we'll walk through ad nauseum and so forth. So take a look at the documentation. It's actually quite good. And then you can download the resources. When you download it's the same as our other resources. It'll unpack it into a Windows Azure folder. And one of the things that's exciting here is we do our best to try to make the configuration of your application as easy as possible. We want as much as possible for you to be able to just F5 and have things run. Mm-hmm. Obviously, most of you know that with Windows Azure, you've got a lot of different services. They've got different credentials, different things that your application needs to be aware of. And sometimes figuring out where to put that stuff and so forth is challenging.
Yeah, here we must have a SQL connection string.
Yep.
We've got a blob storage account and key.
Yep.
We've got ACS namespace that needs to be set up.
And then you've got to configure your ACS, right? Because you've got to add your identity providers to it, set up your relying party, your realm, and then all the rules as well. So we do try our best to make this as easy as possible. So what we've included is a configuration file here. And essentially what it is it's an XML file. So we didn't want to get overly, you know, crazy here. We just wanted to be able to have a place for you to put your specific information in. So for instance, you'll see here is where we can specify the database. So, mm-hmm. you know, by default, everything's configured for running locally. So it's just going to use, you know, SQL, SQL Express, what's ever configured. We'll have a database name. And what we've also done is, you can see we've got a location. Now, since we've got the updated PowerShell commandlets, as part of this, when you get ready to deploy into production, as long as that management certificate has been set up so it knows how to communicate with various provisioning APIs and so forth, we can actually script out and create your SQL database server, your database name, your storage account, your hosted service, et cetera.
So I can put an aspirational value in this
database. It doesn't actually have to exist at this point.
And we'll actually create it. Okay.
Yeah, so that's why now we have locations, so you'll put U.S. South, South Central.
Yeah.
It's documented what all the different values are. But that's what's really nice. So once you've got everything configured here in this XML file, you can run the setup tool. Now, this is the updated dependency checker. So there's a lot of nice enhancements here. First of all, I think it looks a lot cleaner than it used to. And you'll notice that it was just able to check all the dependencies in the background. If I didn't have one of those dependencies installed, you'll just get a warning and you'll get an install button. You click it and it's going to pop you off to the web platform installer to download and install those resources. Then you can do a refresh and it'll check to make sure you have the dependencies. Once that's done, you go ahead and click Next. And here's where we're going to kick off the process of actually going off and, you know, provisioning, configuring, and so forth. One of the things we also do is, based on the values that you put in the that configuration XML file, we'll update the solution as well. So you don't have to then figure out where to go in code to update all those values. So I'm going to go ahead and continue. It's going to ask, have you successfully updated the configuration XML file? I'm going to say yes. Now, if you put something incorrect there, you will get warnings. We try to validate certain things up front, and I'll show you that in a minute. But I'm going to go ahead and say yes. And here's now where it's going to kick off, and it's going to run all those PowerShell scripts for us in the background. So you can see here it's checking if the database exists, and if it does, it's going to drop it, so forth. Actually, it does warn you if you before dropping it automatically. Here we're configuring the access control
just drops
service.
Everything, just to make sure. Actually,
the whole database
server.
Yep.
That's like it's the right one.
Yeah.
It just drops whatever you've got. It's helpful like that.
But so what it's doing is it's essentially updating everything for us. So now, when I come to my solution, you can see here I had it open. It's updated it. Everything's been set up now. I think it's going to show. We might need to. I want to show. We're going to ask Bob, I think, to
have to blur some stuff out.
Okay. Yeah, because I don't want to hide too much. But you can see here we've got our CFCFG file. This is where we set some of the settings. So you can see I've got all my SMTP settings. The SMTP ones are the ones that I really don't want you to see. So
we'll send mail to Bob.
Yeah. So at any rate, we update the solution based on everything that you specified in the configuration. So really, at this point, I can hit F5 and run this sample locally, it'll spin everything up. So, yeah. So let's get that started. So how have you been?
I've been well. How have you been, Wade?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
That's the best we can do for while we're waiting for the thing to spin up.
All right. Now we are using a self-signed cert, so you'll get a warning.
We'll get
just making sure. Everything is good, and we'll go ahead and continue. Now, one thing I want to point out here is, let me go back actually to this configuration XML file. In the past, like if you look at some of the toolkits we've created, we always start with a default admin user.
Yeah.
And it's not always the most secure way to do it, right? Like log in with admin with, you know, a password derived password, you know, the word password in some funky way. So what we've done now is we've created this concept of a bootstrapper. So you can change this value. So essentially that first user that logs in has to also add that bootstrapper administrative key or whatever, and they will automatically be set up and provisioned as the administrator.
Oh,
so this way we don't have anything hard coded with that regard. So I hit BlobShare. It's got a nice looking feel to it.
Yes.
And here are the different identity providers that I've configured through the access control service in that script. And so I'm logging in with my live ID. And I'm going to be prompted to basically choose. Now, the email isn't necessarily derived from what you've logged in with through the access control service. So I could put like my Microsoft account here or whatever. I'm just going to put the same thing, and then I just type in 123456. And so by doing this, now, you know, this account, this login via Live ID is the one associated to BlobShare as the administrator.
Okay.
And so
123456 no longer does anything.
It no longer does anything.
Because we've already got one admin, which means
exactly.
That's it.
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Cool. That's a good
one. So it's ready to use.
That.
So now we actually going to log in because we've updated a permission associated to the user, so not logged in. I'm going to go ahead and do the sign in. Choose Live ID. Of course, the browser is cached the login, and boom, we're in BlobShare. So,
cool.
As an administrator, you actually have quite a few capabilities. So you can let me just walk through these real quick. So obviously, home blobs are where you can actually upload individual files and blobs. So if I wanted to upload videos, I can upload videos, etc. So I'm basically updating the resources. A blob set is a group of blobs. So it's a set of blobs. So if you wanted to give access to an individual to a set of resources, rather than having to do one blob at a time, you can attach blobs to a blob set and then just give the user access to the blob set. We also have a concept of roles. That way you don't have to associate permissions always at the user level. You can define a role, like a Windows Azure MVP, add users to the role, and then give permissions to the role, right? And then, of course, users, you can monitor your invitations, and then we've got reports that basically audit everything in terms of users and so forth. So all that's available to you. To give you an example of kind of what it looks like with a little bit more data, because, you know, I'm going to actually show you what we use to share content. Basically, this is blobshare.dpe.ms. You can try to hit it. You won't be able to get anything because you won't have an account. But to give you an idea of what some of this stuff looks like, because I've got nice data and, you know, stuff that I can show. So I'm going to go ahead and sign in. Now, we've also configured different identity providers. And this is, again, the value of, you know, access control service. One of the identity providers we have is Microsoft. We're using Microsoft's ADFS configured through the access control service. So I can use my corporate account. And so when sharing with individuals here at Microsoft, this is a nice thing to have. So now we're logged in. Show you a couple of things. So if I wanted to add a user, you'll see we have a lot of different users here. I can go in here to invite. And I'm going to say Wade Wagner. Actually, we'll go DPE demo. I've got a DPE demo at live.com account. And I'm going to add them as a, let's see, we'll make them a champ. And go ahead and create that. So what it's doing, I could have added a personal message as well, but this is where it's not only creating the user and getting them set up and associating them to the role, but it's also generated an email invitation to that individual and sent that out. At this point, it is not active because the email is going to have a link, and that link is going to be associated to the invitation. So when the user logs in, whatever login identity that user uses is the one associated to the invitation. So even though I've sent it to an @live.com account, when I go to accept the invitation, I could use...
I could use Facebook.
Exactly. So we'll take a look at what that invite looks like in a moment. I can see here, you know, what pending invitations are there.
This is an unrelated point, but I think it's interesting because we sort of just went past it, which is that email addresses do not equal users.
Correct.
And I think this often, particularly because people are using LiveID a lot, where like the username is formatted like an email address, and so people think of sort of those being one and the same. But here, they're really distinct concepts in that you're sending email to some address. But then when a user logs in, what you really have is some claim about the user. I mean, you sort of have an ID associated with the user that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with an email address at all.
Yep.
And so I think that's just a generally useful point for people to get about identity, is that we should really try to keep those decoupled.
Yeah. So here I'm actually looking at the database that was created locally when I did the initial setup, and you'll see we get a name identifier back from ACS, and that's really the unique identifier that we use you know, in distinguishing, you know, different users from each other. Of course, you know, we use our own primary key and so forth. That's a GUID, so, you know, largely because SQL Azure, you need to have the, you know, a clustered index and so forth on the account.
Right.
But essentially, yeah, this is how we
and
manage
that. And there's other
that.
Stuff associated with, I see a name and an email, whatever, but those are just sort of properties
exactly.
that are associated
metadata.
With the user. Mm-hmm. Really, the user's ID is that thing that you're always going to get back the same one when they authenticate
and
the
ACS. And notice there's no password, none of that stuff, so I don't have to worry about those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Okay.
All right, sorry for that. No, that was great.
Thought
it was an interesting point.
Yeah. So you can see I can take a look at who's not accepted. Oftentimes, like, this was what was really nice about using this internally for a while. Like, people lose their invitations and so forth. So we created the ability to resend the invitation if we wanted to and so forth. So there's a lot of different things that you can end up doing.
Nice.
I'm not going to actually click the blobs. I don't want to necessarily show all the resources, but we've got different blob sets and blobs set up, different roles. You know, you can see we've got administrators, champs, trainers, et cetera. And then reports are what's really interesting. So you can take a look at, you know, who's been doing what. You know, you can take a look at login events. You can take a look at blob downloaded. So you can actually see who's downloading the resources.
Yeah.
So it's a nice way of getting some information about it. And then, as you probably saw here, you could look at user activity, blob activity, or even at the blob set activity level. So.
And when a user does download a blob, that is via a shared access signature.
So
right?
Actually, not necessarily. Yeah. So I knew this would come up.
Okay.
So I wish Vittorio was here. Gosh, I miss. So Vittorio is, you know, Captain Identity.
Commandant Identity. We've promoted him.
Oh, that's right. Was he Commandant or was he Admiral? I think he was Admiral Identity.
All right, fine.
Okay. Vittorio helped out immensely with this because if you think about it, the whole purpose of this is to securely share the resources.
Yeah.
So we're actually not using the shared access signature from the user's perspective. So like when I click a link to download a resource, I'm not using the shared access signature and going off and downloading it. The service, like BlobShare itself, when it's deployed to Windows Azure, is absolutely using shared access signature. When you add the resource, we create a container just called content. And then it's a private, so it'll use, actually I think I misspoke, it's going to use the key and the name in order to get access to the resource directly, and then it will serve that resource back directly to you.
Oh, okay.
So that you're always going through BlobShare in order to access resources.
So there's no way for me to, like,
inadvertently pass off your shared access signature
I
to someone else.
See the link on the thing, copy the URL, and
then
I
get
am
to
a friend of mine.
Exactly.
And have them go directly.
Yep. But the application gives you the ability to revoke permissions, revoke
it
access
gives you
to resources,
sort of capabilities, et cetera. Right. But,
yep. And actually, so if I, interestingly enough, if I come here, let's take a look at this. I can take a look at permissions. I can, when I create permissions here, I can actually, you know, say, you know, give resource access to this for 3 months and grant that. And, you know, it'll create that new permissions policy for it. So that's BlobShare. So it's, take a look at it. I think, like some of the samples we've built in the past, I mean, there's a lot to it. And it's on us, I think, to start decomposing this a little bit to share some of the pertinent things within it. But realize we built it as a tool in turn, like, so we're using it. It's a great resource. It works well. And I would love for you guys to take a look at it, you know, other people to take a look at it as well. So give it a try.
All right.
So that's it.
It's that time, isn't it?
It is that time.
It's time for the intro to the tip of the week.
Yeah, last week was a good one. So I don't know if anyone saw it. Yeah. You got to see what I did in Hawaii.
Bob's been on a roll with these ones. What are we going to do for this one?
We've been talking a lot about blobs.
Okay.
Is there something like...
Yeah, maybe we can do some blob
Attack
thing.
Of the Killer Blobs.
I believe... Isn't there a movie called The Blob?
The Blob? Yes. Yes.
I don't know what the copyright situation is on that, but...
well, we
I
use
don't
stuff
know,
from YouTube all the time, right?
Blobby.
Yeah.
There's plenty, I'm sure Bob can think of something with blobs. So, yeah, let's
cool.
Let's
all right, blobs.
All right,
great. And with that, here's your
here's
tip of the week.
Tip of the week.
Every one of you watching this screen, look out, because soon, very soon, the most horrifying monster menace ever conceived will be oozing into this theater. There's no stopping the blob as it spreads from town to town.
And we're back.
All right, so I've got a tip for us this week. I've got a little blog post about it.
It is a little blog post.
Basically, but this is the TUI we were mentioning earlier, the textual user interface, which is basically, this came from a question that got asked internally on a distribution list inside of Microsoft, where somebody was asking, you know, I've just got an executable, it listens on port 80, I want to put it in Windows Azure and have it serve up HTTP traffic. I don't want Visual Studio, I don't want, like, I don't want to learn anything, really, I just want to know, I know there are command line tools and whatever. What's the basic project setup I need, config settings and whatever, to just get this packaged up to something I can deploy to Windows Azure? So I went and made one.
Yeah.
And I thought we would just go through it. We're gonna try something scary. Which
I haven't actually tried this, so you're gonna walk me through
what this is about, and
nope.
We're gonna see if we can do it. So click on downloads. Do you see downloads up? In the tabs there. And download a zip. You could, of course, just git clone this, but I don't know if you have the git tool set up.
I do have git set up, but this is still easier.
Well, let's do this way. Let's just unzip that somewhere.
Does it matter where?
I don't think it does. But open a command prompt to get in here, because, of course, this is a 2E.
Oh, do I need...
Right. So
is that one fine?
That'll be fine. Well, we have to start... What we will need to do is it needs to be a Windows Azure SDK thing, but you can do that from here, actually. You can just go... it's Program Files, Windows Azure SDK... I was going to have you do it from... Okay, fine. Do it this way. I don't know if we have for it anymore. See, this is why we should have tried this once before.
Okay. Do we not have it packaged in...
No, but I know how to do it anyway.
Okay.
Just open... Get back to your command prompt from here. And just go / program files, Windows Azure SDK, not that one, that one.
There's a lot.
V1.4, it's I think only one directory in here. Bin, setenv. There's a setenv in here which will do it. Yep, that's it.
Cool.
So just hit enter, and then now you got to get back to the directory, unfortunately. It changes the directory.
No worries.
But go back in there. So the reason we have to do this is because what this is going to do is it's going to run CSPack and CSRun, which are only in your path once you've sort of set it up here.
Yep.
So you can actually, if we just want to try it out, just hit build, and then that's it, and then let it run for a second, and then do run. and we can at least see it working. So this should start up the, you already had the emulator running, but this would start up the emulator. It should tell us in a second what port we're on. So we're on port 81. So you can just browse to port 81, to localhost 81. And if everything worked, this is a good test for it. You should see a little... There you go. A hello world. So there you go. So that is coming from... So if we go back to sort of the directory structure, maybe we can go back and explore and kind of look. If you double-click into worker role, this is what's actually running. So there's an index.html. There's Mongoose, which is my favorite, like, single executable web server. It's really lightweight. That's the only file you need. And a run.cmd. And so what this project is actually configured to do is run this batch file. And this batch file, I should probably take out that echo. That was just for debugging. But basically, this batch file launches Mongoose and tells it what address and port to listen on and spits things out to an error log, too. And that's about it. So if you want to understand how it all works, go look at the service definition file and the config file, although the config file doesn't really have anything in it.
All right, let's look at this.
But the definition file has a program entry point, which we did talk about as a news item at one point. We talked about a blog post from Nate about using that. But the program entry point is what says, hey, what we're doing is we're doing run.cmd. And these environment variables are set, so I'm extracting from the input endpoint, I'm extracting the address and the port. This is actually interesting. You need the address more than you used to. So you used to, you might have run Mongoose and just done -p81, right? Just run it on the right port. That worked, actually, until SDK 1.5. Because until SDK 1.5, if you ran multiple instances of a web role, they just got different ports. Now they actually tend to all get the same port, but on different IP addresses. It's actually 1.7.0.0.2 or something. Like, they're actually on different addresses, which means if you just try to open port 81, you'll get a conflict because that's what the load balancer is using in the emulator. That's what the other instance is using. And so you actually need to take the address into account. And so that's why I have environment variables that capture the address for that endpoint and the port. And I pass both of those into Mongoose.
Great.
But anyway, but Mongoose is just an example. You don't necessarily need to have an input endpoint. You don't need environment variables. You could just have an executable that's sort of like a worker role kind of thing. You could just drop that in there. Instead of run.cmd, you could run that directly, or you could write a batch file to do it. And that's it. I guess the last thing we should, if you go back to that command window and type pack, that's it. Yeah, pack should open up... should turn this into a .cspkg. And that's all you need to go deploy. And I have tested that much out and actually deployed it up to the cloud. And if you really want to remain a command line junkie, you can use the PowerShell commandlets or my Ruby gem or write your own. But there are lots of ways that you can do sort of command line based deployment. So you can do that too. So
we'll ask David Aiken to write something.
We'll have David Aiken do it, yeah. So no Visual Studio, no GUI at all, didn't have to write any XML. You might have to edit that. Depending on what you're doing, you might have to edit a little XML. Mm-hmm. But if all you need is port 80 and just run an executable, it's pretty much just make that batch file do the thing you want, and you're kind of done.
That's great.
So that's all up on Git, and so you can clone it or fork it if you want, or as we showed, you can always just download the zip file. So. Yeah.
Very
so
cool.
That works too.
I've been noticing you've got you're starting to accumulate quite a lot of resources.
Yeah, I'm starting to do a lot more on GitHub, including some stuff that I don't think I've really like announced, but it's sort of there.
Yeah. This is Mark Scratch. I'm really interested in.
Yeah, that one's the best one by far. Yeah, there is some stuff there. So if you want, you can also follow me there, and you'll catch those things before I blog them. I usually have them up there, so you can actually.
Am I one of your followers?
You can catch that.
I don't follow you. Well, here you go.
You should.
Now I do.
All right, just went up to 23. It doesn't
actually refresh.
Okay, so
at some point.
So
anyway, great tip. Thank you.
Sure.
That was a good tip.
So next week.
Next week.
Next week, I am not going to be available.
Yes, but we've got a special guest. I'm not saying who.
I'm very sad that
I'm
not available because we do have a very special guest.
I am too.
former President Bill Clinton will be on the show. No, it's not quite that special. Or it's more special.
It's more special.
Maybe it's more special.
To all of us.
It's all
of us. Yep. Yeah. All the viewers.
All right, that's all we're going to say about it. But anyway, that's going to be a great show. I won't be here, but Wade and our special guest will do
It'll
a great
fun.
Job.
It'll be fun.
And that'll be good. I won't be here, of course, because I will be at the Seattle Interactive Conference.
Yes. Where is it at again?
I believe it's in Seattle. And it's a conference. And it's really, the style of it is kind of interactive.
Yeah.
So
there's a full cloud track. And it's going to be great.
Track.
I mean, James Conner will be there. Steve will be there. Rob Tiffany will be there. Scott Dinsmore.
Yep.
Nick Harris. Nathan Totten. It's going to be great.
It's everybody. So
except for me.
So
I can't
go. You'll still have a chance. I mean, it's getting kind of close. By the time you see us talking about this, it's going to be the Friday before the thing, which starts Wednesday. I think
right.
It's Wednesday.
Wednesday and Thursday.
I think you will still be able to. I hope you can still sign up if it's that it's not too late.
So or if you're already signed
Seattle
up.
Area, you do that. If you're already signed up, good to remember that you're signed up and remember to actually go. So I will see you in 2 weeks, but stay here. Stay tuned for next week.
Yeah, that'll be
good.
It'll
be really special.
It'll be special.
All right.
If you have any comments, thoughts, questions, things that you'd like to see, you can always tweet us at @CloudCoverShow.
And you can always tweet to @TheDavidAiken.
And @TheDavidAiken,
if
yes.
you have comments on his stuff.
Yeah. Don't forget the.
The David Aiken.
Yeah.
So, all right.
All right. And with that, thank you very much.
Thanks.